It's my great pleasure to welcome you all today to the first event of the semester. For those of you that don't know me, my name's Professor Benjamin Hopkins. I'm the director here at the Seeger Center. And it is my great pleasure to welcome a friend and colleague today, Neelish Bose, who's an assistant professor of history and the Canadian Research Chair at the University of Victoria in Victoria, British Columbia. I snagged Neelish because he emailed to ask me about housing around the Library of Congress, and I said, oh, you're going to be in town, then you're going to give a paper. So it's with that that I've dragged him in today, and Neelish is going to talk about some of his forthcoming work, a biography of Tariknath Dasht, and he's going to present one of the chapters of that work today. Neelish has published widely. His main book, Recasting the Region, Language, Culture, and Islam in Colonial Bengal, came out with Oxford University Press in 2014. He's widely published in Modern Asian Studies, the Colonial Journal of Colonialism and Colonial History, and Modern Intellectual History, if I remember correctly. So with that, let's turn it over to Neelish.
Thank you so much, Ben, for the invitation and for the introduction. And thank you to all of you for spending your time here today on such a warm day. And perhaps the first week of school. I don't know if this is the first week, so before things get too crazy, I suppose. Okay, so today I will look at the impact and significance of South Asian migrants in the U.S. and Canada borderlands in the early 20th century through the mid-1920s, a period of rising global white supremacy and the so-called global color line, as has been remarked by many, through the experience of one person, Tariknath Dasht, an itinerant nationalist and political activist from India, alive from 1884 to 1958. And by looking at his itinerary in these first two decades of the 20th century, from study in the Norwich Military Academy in Vermont to service in the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service in 1907-08, work with the Gather Movement, San Francisco, 1913-14, and his arrest and conviction in the Hindu-German conspiracy trial of 1917-18, and his subsequent imprisonment in Leavenworth, 1918-19, and some of his writings, I will explore the nationalism of so-called expatriate patriots as seen within the context of settler colonialism and the frontiers of expanding settler states like the United States and Canada. I find that his life and his thought makes most sense within a comparative context that includes other itinerants like Mohandas Gandhi, alive from 1869 to 1948, Shyamji Krishna Varma, active in Europe in the 1910s and 20s, alive from 1857 to 1930, and Lala Lajpat Rai, 1836 to 1928, also a visitor to the United States in the early 20th century. So the world of Dasht in the early 20th century from 1908, his arrival to the U.S. through 1925, his departure away to Europe, is what I will present today, which is a part of a chapter of, as Ben mentioned, a biography that I'm working on Dasht himself. So the history of Asian migration to North America in the era of global imperial transformation at the turn of the 20th century rose to headlines just as the world witnessed not only the aspiration for and the European rejection of self-determination for colonized peoples, but also the hardening layers of white settler politics in the Anglophone spaces of North America, Southern Africa, and the Pacific. At this moment, the world witnessed the rise of Mohandas Gandhi in the border regions between the newly established Boer republics of the late 19th century, like the Transvaal in the 1890s and 1900s, and the expanding British colonial South African state. In North America, during the time of Gandhi, the history of Asian migration from the early 20th century to the 1920s is usually told through the histories of East Asians active in North American spaces in various ways from the 1860s as major drivers of historical change regarding migration within the United States, Canada, and Mexico. And South Asians have entered this narrative primarily through considerations of borderlands politics, interracial intimacy and passing, and as well overseas Indian nationalism. A few staple reference points in this broader history includes the expelling of East Asian migrants at particular moments from 1882, the beginning of the Asian Exclusion Act in the United States, and the landmark 1885 anti-Chinese riots, which spread throughout the Pacific Northwest as Chinese migrants were expelled from Seattle, Tacoma, Portland, and Olympia, keynotes in the burgeoning, quote, settler West. By the mid-1880s, expulsion campaigns of Asians, primarily East Asians, were underway in California, Oregon, and Washington states, all states that were recently constructed constructed in the process of Western settler expansion from the 1850s onward. By the early 20th century, inclusive of Asians from various parts of Asia. In broad historical terms, the expulsions of Asians from North America became the issue from the 1880s to 1917, and from 1917 to the end of the interwar period, the expulsions of Asians, as well as other Mexican and other Central American migrants from the southern border, started to occur simultaneously in increasing numbers. So after decades of East Asian migration in North America, South Asians in the fuzzy legal and social spaces of the Western North American borderlands between the U.S. and Canada were parts of layers of migration and diverse types of inclusion and exclusion in between an expanding settler nation state like the U.S. and Canada, which was a dominion of the British Empire since 1867. And in both of these states, the Western reaches were being confronted by Asian, European, and indigenous interactions on both sides of the border. There are records of individuals from South Asia in port cities east and west since the late 18th century. But large numbers of South Asian laborers appear in British Columbia and throughout the Pacific Northwest from the 1890s in Washington, Oregon, and British Columbia, and portions of California, just as expulsion campaigns against Chinese migrants and later Japanese migrants were growing in number and scale. In the broader context of migration in the colonial period, the numbers here are quite small compared to other regions, like within the Indian Ocean. At this time, millions migrated from India to Malaya, the Straits settlements, Sri Lanka, and Burma over the 1834 to 1930 period. And in those cases, mostly Tamil and Bengali and Bihari male laborers. Whereas in this case, in the Americas, approximately 80,000 South Asians in that time period migrated to Canada, Australia, Hawaii, Mexico, Panama, and Argentina. And the most politically visible portion of these migrants were found in the borderland regions of the Pacific Northwest. And so it is here that Tariknath Dash is one of the few itinerant Asians actively employed by the state authorities he would later frequently critique and therefore deserves a serious investigation. So he enters this settler formation in the Pacific Northwest in 1906. He's born in 1884 in Birbhum, western Bengal, north of Calcutta, and as a teenager, he was reared in the actively nationalist milieu of the Bengali youth of his generation, one of the first members of the Onushilan Shomiti, radical revolutionary group that started in Bengal in the 1900s. He traveled abroad to Japan with fellow Onushilan members, this revolutionary group, in 1905. And he aimed to gain both education and anti-colonial training, like many of his contemporaries in Japan. The Japanese authorities expelled him from the country in 1906, and he crosses the Pacific Ocean from Japan and enters North America via Seattle. In 1906, works on the railroads and in various odd jobs, and moves to San Francisco in late 1906. And from a Northern Californian base, he then traveled to Washington and Oregon and found a burgeoning community of Indian laborers working in lumber and shingle mills, small-scale agriculture, celery farms, and various seasonal labor, and again, in the numbers of the thousands. In 1907, he obtained a job as a laboratory helper at the University of California, Berkeley, and applied for the first time. He applies three times in his life, but for the first time he applies for U.S. citizenship, 1907, and he's denied on the grounds that Asians at that time were not considered white and therefore not eligible for citizenship. In 1907, Dash witnessed and then wrote about and intervened in the public discourse around two particular riots in September of that year. The Vancouver riots, the first one, against Asians of all different types, of all different parts of Asia, where white settler riots had been occurring since the 1890s, Dash began the Hindustani Association and was interviewed by the Daily Province in Vancouver. And he enters the Canadian Record in this year, 1907, by noting how his goal was to look after the immigration rights of Hindus, a term that he uses for most of the period. He was also close to and then wrote about in 1907 the riots in Bellingham, Washington, against primarily South Asian laborers, and began to develop a cross-border system of support and information gathering between British Columbia, Washington, Oregon, and California. In 1907, a Canadian Dominion Secret Service agent, McInnes, and then later, the quite well-known William Hopkinson, declared Dash to be the ringleader behind the connections of South Asians across the U.S. and Canada border, and therefore worthy of attention, tied both to the protections of laborers and soon to the support of Indian independence. So part of Dasch's access to the burgeoning world of surveillance, which was growing in the early 20th century, was his work for the Immigration Service in Vancouver, the U.S. Immigration Service in Vancouver, from 1907 to 1908, summer of 1907 to April of 1908. At the end of this term of work, he started the Free Hindustan, a newspaper and a mouthpiece of the growing anti-colonial movement for Indian nationalism. The first edition of this newspaper, published in April of 1908, included long pieces about famine in India and designated the causes of famine in India to be British policy, included articles about Indian religion, German revolutions of 1848, various kinds of things that one would see in other comparable publications in India. It brought more attention on him, this newspaper did, by Dominion and British authorities who had urged the United States to stop publication of the paper. It was published in the US. But since he was not technically breaking the law, he was asked to resign because both the Dominion and British authorities were onto him. But he was not breaking any law. He did resign, and then through the help of his partners who had funded this organization, many Irish nationalists who had created the Gaelic American in New York City, it started to resume publication of the Free Hindustan in 1909. Then, this is all in the Pacific Northwest, 1907, 1908. Then in 1909, he moves to a region inside the interior of BC, Millside, British Columbia, and then starts to circulate other papers that he gets sent to him from a growing network of people throughout the country, Swadesh Sevak, the Aryan, and a few others, that start to circulate between BC, Washington, and Oregon and California. In 1908, Tariknath Dasch, he received a letter from Leo Tolstoy, which then became noted by Mohandas Gandhi in South Africa, to which Dasch made a detailed reply. The contents of his reply demonstrate his nationalism of the period, which would be very much like his contemporaries in India. And he put forth in this reply to Tolstoy, who wrote about why Indians should not, in a sense, be fighting for independence. They should be looking for changing their own relationships to religion and to violence, very much like Gandhi would say a bit later. But Dasch is putting forth in this reply a normative drain theory of empire, that the real fault line and cause of the misery of India was economic exploitation, creation of famines, as well as investment in enforced cultivation of opium, not, as Tolstoy initially had suggested, and as Gandhi later would, that the problem of India was in the mindsets of Indians themselves. And this prompted, of course, many trajectories in Gandhi's own politics. South Africa is not a connection only in this sense, but Dasch was very much aware of the Indian community in South Africa, as the files on him in the US and Canada show a handwritten mailing list of Indians resident in South Africa in 1908 and 1909, and 2,000 copies of this list were allegedly sent in early 1909 from him to his associates in different parts of the United States, according to US intelligence. So he's, of course, very aware of the Indian South African community, as evidenced by these papers. In 1908, as this is growing, this awareness of him by the US and Canadian authorities is growing, he leaves the Pacific Northwest to attend Norwich University, a military training academy. And the correspondence around him, though mentioning that he was a very good student, his teachers stated that he was someone who was advocating war against a state with which the United States was at peace, that being the British Empire. And as he aimed, once he got into Norwich, to apply for the National Guard, this was a problem for Norwich University. So this matter of concern led the university to expel him from Norwich in 1909. The military academy held a long tradition of preparing its graduates in the late 19th century in so-called Indian wars against an internal indigenous enemy. But around this time, the early 20th century, and just before and during World War I, shifted course to tracking external threats, anarchists, and migrants. And Dasch is really at the center of this transformation of the military and state-level monitoring of individuals inside of the United States to transfer into external threats from the outside. He is suspended, as I mentioned, in 1909 because of his advocacy against the ally of the United States at that time, the British Empire, and then traverses the continent again and finds his way back to Seattle, enters the University of Washington, Seattle, earns a BA in political science in 1910, and then starts to research for an MA on employer liability law and works with laborers in Berkeley and in other parts of California and earns a master's degree in 1911. And he shuttles between Oregon and California, working for Washington State's Challis County Superior Court as a part-time interpreter, and interprets in Hindi and in Punjabi into English in various trials that are encountering South Asian migrants, like the St. John's trial in Oregon in the spring of 1910, in which a few individuals and members of the police were implicated in attacks on Indian laborers. And those policemen and other individuals stood trial for these attacks, and he translated during that trial. As an interpreter, he published a prominent piece in the Morning Oregonian, this is 1910, declaring that Indians' former high regard for America as the land of liberty stood in the breach of this trial. And he ended by calling on the right-minded and better class of the public to essentially convict those charged with rioting, as well as the police who were implicated in this riot. The Oregon authorities were aware of Dosh, given the newly found attention that people like him were receiving by Dominion officials, meaning Canada, and U.S. immigration officials, and he had worked for the U.S. Immigration Service, so he was quite well-known, and the British Empire. Like one figure, W.G. Hopkinson, William Hopkinson, the Anglo-Indian immigration inspector, known for a detailed chasing of Dosh and other figures like Har Dayal. After Dosh applies for citizenship in 1911 in Seattle for the second time, and fails to receive it, Hopkinson starts to follow Dosh intently, and a love-hate relationship of sorts emerges. Hopkinson, in his correspondence, declares him to be an anarchist in collusion with Canadian radicals, but is awed by his networks and his connections and his ability to speak to people from South Africa to the east coast of the U.S. to India. From 1911 to 1914, Hopkinson has a base in San Francisco and then works with his Canadian colleagues across the border and plants Indian informants and spies in Vancouver and in San Francisco to learn about what Dosh is doing. At this time, Dosh spent considerable time in Oregon as he registered a company, the Bandon Clay Products Company, through gifts from various families that he had come to know in Oregon and in California. He must have been a charmer for those wealthy Pacific Northwest families who wanted to register companies in his name. News leaked that he possibly had planned to use this company as a front for training militant revolutionaries to fight against the British Empire. 1912, Dosh filed a citizenship application in Oregon. It was denied, not officially because of race, but because of his financial dealings and, quote, moral character, the shady registering of companies through other people's names. In 1913, after this application was denied, with a newly arrived Indian scholar and nationalist, Har Dayal, and others, Santokh Singh, Sohan Singh Bakna, he starts the Pacific Coast Hindustan Association, later known as the Gadar Party. And this party saw a rise of infiltration from Hopkinson, the Anglo-Indian inspector, and his network, first captivated by Dosh, and then Har Dayal,